It is always difficult to make any accurate or verifiable statements or predictions. We go as best we can by clues and signs and symptoms and feelings. The context of my stress on the recovery of the Christological, in the sense of the Theologia Crucis, the theology of the cross, and my appeal to think about mission and ministry from the perspective of the apostolic imperatives, the context is the secularizing process, which takes many forms, now underway. Not out there in the world where we have placed it, but now inside the body. Many questions were raised last night. Is it really possible? Can it possibly be that the cancer of secularization or of culture conformism, what Karl Barth called Kulturprotestantismus, it was his charge against the whole of modern Protestantism, 19th century Protestantism in Europe. Is it possible that this has now entered the body of the church which we love so much? And is there any empirical evidence? What are the signs? What can you point to that anything serious is wrong in the body? Well, we all see things from different perspectives. It all depends on where you take your readings. When I was a graduate student in Heidelberg, Germany, I got a bad case of the flu. So I went to the clinic to see a doctor. The first thing he wanted to do was to take my temperature. Of course, I already knew I was sick. So he took a rather large thermometer out of the disinfecting solution, he handed it to me, and he left the room. And I put the thermometer in my mouth, right under my tongue, like you're supposed to do. A few minutes later, the doctor returned to the room and suddenly had a shocked look on his face. And he said, "You didn't put that thermometer in your mouth, did you? Mein Gott!" And then a horrible thought crossed my mind. As I said to him, "Well, where did you expect me to stick it?" And he said, "Well, it's not that kind of thermometer. That's not the way we do it here. We put it here, like so." And he stuck it under my armpit. So if you're taking the temperature of the body, which in this case is the church, it makes a difference where you stick it. They say that, some are saying that the headquarters of the new Lutheran church will be in Kansas City, because that's the armpit of the United States. Well, I'm from Chicago. I've been there 20 years. I don't like it there. But no doubt I'm reflecting what I've experienced, what I've seen in the church. At the new church conference held in Chicago in 1983, Gerhard Ferdi gave a paper on the role of theology in the church. And he traced, essay, by the way, that he gave there is available in the New Church Debate, the title of a book, The New Church Debate. And he traced the decline and demise of its significance in favor of, in the direction of, a non-theological style of corporation management, from confessional theological norms to functionalist bureaucratic procedures. And people became visibly disturbed and angry with him. And if you know Ferdi, he's a very mild-mannered person. But they turned their hostility against Ferdi because he had touched some very raw nerves. There are symptoms of an illness that merger will not cure. I am incapable of taking a Pollyanna, Schuller-esque approach to the condition we are now a part of. How can anything be wrong when we feel so good? There are symptoms given in the fact that dissenting groups are springing up, calling attention to religious and moral trends deeply reflecting the culture-conforming tendencies affecting not only Christianity elsewhere, but also our own homegrown type of Christianity. But you see, I'm off my subject because it is not my point to make a case for the diagnosis, but to urge upon us a solution which I believe is valid, no matter how sick we are, no matter how good we feel, and that is the reestablishment of offices that signal the dynamics of apostolic ministry in the church today. Even if we're only suffering a slight rash due to environmental pollution, we still must nourish the body on apostolic nutrients calculated to make and keep the body whole and well. One further footnote. Last night in my comment about the decline of male candidates for ministry, some inferred that this complaint implied something negative about the increase in the number of women studying at the seminary. Well, we've become terribly sensitive. For the record, there is, to my knowledge, no cause and effect relation between these two facts. I say it is fortunate. I think I said it is fortunate. I would say now it is providential that women are studying theology for ministry. Women have always been in the church's ministries as missionaries, evangelists, deaconesses, social workers, parish workers, religious educators. Now they are studying theology in preparation for ordained ministry, so-called, and that is long overdue, and it is something for which we can be extremely thankful. We need women and men together in ministry in all areas. The problem about apostolic ministry in the church, however, is not a gender problem. Keeping women out, like the Pope proposes, and Anglo-Catholics and High Church Lutherans, like they demand, does not guarantee apostolicity, nor does a new quota system give us a new boost of apostolic vitality. You can't fix the car by a new paint job. From the standpoint of a theology of the cross, using apostolic criteria of charismatic identity and mission, there is neither male nor female. We all have an equal chance to be witnesses and martyrs for the cross of Christ. It should not be held against you, nor give you an inside track, however you happen to have been born. Well, that's how I read the script of apostolic Christianity. The problem of ministry today has to do with the history of the transmission of the authority of Christ and the gospel from apostolic times to post-apostolic times. And the theological problem is, how can the apostolic church continue to be true? How can the sub-apostolic church and the ongoing reality of the church in history continue to be true to the apostolic witness after all the apostles have passed away? How could their authority continue to be effective and to be channeled in the coming generations? Our answer yesterday was, well, that's why they wrote the New Testament. because the memory could possibly fade away and some things could be lost concerning the identity, the person, and the benefits of Jesus Christ. They wrote down their words of preaching. But also, the office of ministry in the church. That is the written word and the living word, without which the church cannot survive. The church of later times can only remain close to Jesus the Christ through the office of preaching and teaching the apostolic word and witness passed on through the canonical scriptures and normed thereby. Today I wish to focus more closely on the ecumenical problem of the appropriate office or offices to be entrusted with the authentic transmission of the apostolic voice of authority. And we will begin with the peculiar way in which the problem strikes Lutheranism, which stands in a pivotal position between Catholics and evangelicals on the doctrine of the ministry. The Lutheran perspective on the nature of the ministry can be traced to a basic inconsistency in Luther's own thought. If you think we're confused, read Luther. This inconsistency continues to bedevil the Lutheran Church in the 20th century. Neither Luther's understanding of justification by faith nor his interpretation of Scripture provided him with an unambiguous position over against the Roman Catholic view of the ministry as a sacerdotal priesthood, nor that of the Protestant enthusiasts, the Schwärmer, who retained no special office of the ministry. In his writing on the councils and the churches, Luther listed the office of the ministry as a fifth mark of the church, after the word of baptism, the Lord's Supper, and absolution. And then he placed also suffering, martyrdom, and the cross. For the sake of the gospel, it is necessary for the church to have the office of the ministry. All Christians are members of the universal priesthood by virtue of baptism. This is what Luther said. In principle, every Christian is endowed with the right to preach and administer the sacraments. And yet the community calls and ordains a few to the public performance of these services. That is, all Christians are priests, but not all are pastors. And what was Luther trying to say? Is the office of the ministry based on the priesthood of all Christians, or did Christ himself institute it? Luther scholars and Lutheran theologians are divided on the answer to this question. Each side tends to force Luther into a mold of consistency to agree with its own dogmatic preference. The one side holds that the ministry is a holy office based explicitly on a divine ordinance. God has commanded and instituted the office of the word. The other side claims that for Luther, all Christians are commissioned to be servants of the word, but the rights of all are transferred. Magic word, transferred to a few to avoid confusions. Are these two points of view like poles in a dialectical tension, or are we confronted with sheer contradiction? In his polemical writings from 1519 to 1523, Luther derived the office from the universal priesthood. He was fighting the Roman faction. Later, Luther stressed more emphatically the divine institution of the office. He was fighting the enthusiasts. As a theologian, Luther was an occasionalist, not a systematician like Calvin. He wrote on the run, with a Bible in one hand and a beer mug in the other, going after crisis. This is particularly evident in his writings on the church and the ministry. Lutheran churches around the world have participated in the ecumenical search for a theology of the ministry that might overcome the obstacles to reunion. They have not been able to discover in Luther firm foundations. Rather, their recourse to Luther has more often confirmed whatever preferences they sought to vindicate. In pushing the demands of a radical laicism, Luther is remembered as the champion against the priestly tyranny of Rome, and therefore against clerical monopoly of power. Those fighting this battle will quote Luther to desacralize ordination and discount its chain-like connection with a succession of office holders. Was not the universal priesthood of believers the great religious principle of the Reformation, inviting each believer to intercede with God directly apart from the mediatorial function of the priesthood? Does not this principle also entail the laity's right to private interpretation of the Bible without bowing to the magisterial authority of popes and bishops? Luther in his tower room became for Protestant Christians the picture of the truly liberated person. Consequently, the church is pictured as primarily a group of individual believers who gather together to share their private experiences. So who then is the minister? The minister is the facilitator of these subjective experiences, the person with the skills to draw out the potential of each and build a support group. The minister is the one who has been delegated by the group to perform certain functions in behalf of all. This doctrine is called the transference theory, from the German Übertragungslehre, the transference theory. It makes the office a function of the whole congregation. Today it is called the functionalist view of the ministry. In rejecting the Roman doctrine of the priesthood, it levels down the church. Quoting Luther, all Christians are preachers and all preachers are Christians. Statements that are patently false on both ends. The problem with this view is that it can make no clear distinction between the office of the ministry and the priesthood of all believers. Many Lutherans feel confident they can appeal to Luther to support their functionalizing view of the ministry. In speaking of the ministry of the word, they start with a universal priesthood, and accordingly, they place a low value on ordination. The ministry is nothing more than the exercise of rights and privileges that originally belong to all, which they have delegated to one functionary for the sake of good order. The minister then becomes a mouthpiece of the congregation. This is a view that appeals to the democratic and congregationalist temperament of Americans. It has been taught by many Lutheran dogmaticians and church leaders. And it now has a fairly strong grip on the minds of those who manage the bureaucracies of the church. Luther speculated about what would have to happen in an emergency situation if a group of lay folk should find themselves on a desert island without a preacher. They could choose any one of them to preach, to administer the sacraments, and in general, exercise the office of the keys. Ordination in that emergency situation would mean nothing. Ironically, congregational Lutherans have developed a doctrine of the ministry on the model of an emergency situation. The emergency situation has been going on now for over 400 years. But of course, in practice, everybody's doing it. Everybody is still retaining the right of ordination. As ordination is taking place, they mutter to themselves, it's not a sacrament. It doesn't bestow anything real, nothing indelible, no supernatural stigma. I'm just one of the people. And this is not a sign of succession leading back to the apostles, conveying their authority to speak. Those who hear you, hear me. It's just a ceremony. We can readily see how this idea of the minister's status determines the question of authority. In our democratic system of thinking, when people no longer feel they are being fairly represented by their delegated representative, they can terminate the contract. This word contract has now entered into our vocabulary. They pay the minister's salary, after all. If they are not getting their money's worth, they can trade their minister in for another. It takes no great imagination to see that the psychological and sociological ramifications of the minister's dilemma actually have deep roots in a doctrinal problem. This root leads to a tremendous loss of apostolic substance. It opens the way for Christianity to become a civil religion, the sweet honey and the comb of our secular society, at the mercy of popular trends and the religion that makes it on the electronic media. Contemporary Luther scholarship, for the most part, has robbed the transference theory of the right to claim his solid support. The more widely supported view now in Luther scholarship is that Luther shifted his emphasis in later years. When he found that his more conservative Reformation was being outflanked by the radical reformers, he then put greater stress on the importance of the office. There is no reason to rob from Peter to pay Paul. To play the office of the ministry off against the charism of the Spirit granted to every believer in baptism. Both the preaching office and the general priesthood are founded by divine institution. And this divine institution is ultimately based on the work of Christ. The transference theory depends on a highly selective use of Luther quotes fired off in the heat of battle against the presumptuous claims of the Roman hierarchy. Opposed to the transference theory is that of the divine institution of the office through Christ himself and the apostles, and not first through the Spirit-filled members of the congregation. In my self-consciousness, this difference makes all the difference in the world. American Lutherans have inherited the tensions and contradictions in Luther's understanding of the ministry from the 19th century controversies surrounding the views of C.F.W. Walter and Wilhelm Löhe. Lutherans in North America were involved in bitter disputes concerning the nature of the church and its ministry, and those theological problems were not solved in the 19th century, and now the chickens are coming home to roost. Sometime you should reread that chapter in church history, the dispute between J.A.A. Grabow of the Buffalo Synod and C.F.W. Walter of the Missouri Synod concerning the meaning of ordination and its relation to the church. So Lutherans have lived with these inherited tensions and contradictions, and we have not yet broke through into the clearing. The last decades have witnessed one comprehensive study after the other on the doctrine of the ministry in all the Lutheran church bodies. Each one of them has tried to walk a tightrope between two views on the ministry that can indeed be traced back to Luther's own writings. This lack of decisiveness, this waffling, has placed the ministry on shaky foundations, and today it threatens the primacy of the means of grace in the divine administration of the church. If the transference theory is correct, the minister has no real authority, and worse than that, what authority the minister does have is taken from the laity. The lack of a clear view of the ministerial office reflects itself in a great deal of confusion about the relation of the laity to the ministry. The way to recover the lay apostolate is not merely by making lay people more active in the church and more visible in liturgical roles, but by helping the laity to be the diaspora church in the world. The ministry has become the most debated topic on the ecumenical agenda. To clarify the problems of the ministry in present-day Christianity, we're going to take a few samplings leading up to the new and marvelous document which we have before us now as Lutheran churches, the so-called Lima document on baptism, Eucharist, and ministry. Roman Catholic theology has developed a new understanding of the church as people of God and of the ministry as diaconia. That is on the basis of biblical studies. This has helped it to bring about considerable rapprochement with traditions that stem from the Reformation. Luther's emphasis on the universal priesthood of believers has been reclaimed as an essential part of the Catholic tradition. Roman Catholic theology can now say, now that we are taking seriously the universal priesthood and we are responding to Luther's appeal for a full integration of all Christians into the fullness of the church, what are you? What are you Protestants doing to attain a fuller realization of the manifoldness of the structures of the church? What are we doing? However far Lutherans find it possible to move toward a new ecumenical consensus on the ministry, they will surely wish to bring along the strength of their distinctive confessional emphases. We have previously argued that there are two channels of apostolic succession. There's the written word and the living word, canon and office. If Lutherans have been weak on office, they have been strong on canon. And that's an emphasis that we cannot afford to lose. We should not allow the pendulum to swing to the other side, to the side of a kind of Episcopalianism, which has been strong on office and weak on canon. We do not have to be a one-dimensional church. Luther and the confessional writings are correct in emphasizing the priority of the Word of God and its authority over popes, bishops, councils, and synods. This is the confessional principle and the scriptural principle working hand in hand. Our tradition is also correct in interpreting apostolic succession as a succession in the apostolic spirit, the apostolic faith, and the apostolic confession. But do we have to stop at that? Can this view, this traditional view, satisfactorily counter the charge of ecclesiological docetism? Granted that the Word of God is the authority in the church, the next question, what are the appropriate mediating structures of that authority? Does it happen invisibly by osmosis? That fits the view of the church as made up of true believers who belong to the invisible church. But what is the channel of apostolic authority in the visible church, which is the only one which needs theology? We don't worry about the invisible church. We're not ordained into the invisible church. This docetism, whenever things get hot and difficulty, we start talking about the invisible church, ecumenism of the invisible church. Everybody's in favor of that. But what about the visible church? There is a docetism, not only in Christology, but in ecclesiology. And it goes along with a certain Lutheran tendency to enthusiasm, Schwärmerei, in the sense Luther applied to the left-wing radicals. And we have to admit that Luther's own teaching from time to time on the ministry was tainted by a certain spiritualizing of the office. Just a footnote, Grabow, in this conflict between Grabow and Walter, Grabow of the Buffalo Synod called the Missouri ministers, who started up their own ministry from the laity, Roten Prediger. That's what Lutherans called each other when they got angry. Their ordination was not valid, he said. The transference theory is false doctrine, even if it can boast of some choice Luther quotations. All Christians have the right to interpret the scriptures. All are subject to the authority of the Word of God. Indeed, does this principle of lay universality mean that no further distinctions need to be made? It is at this point that the Catholic tradition in ecumenical discussion today challenges Protestants and us Lutherans. The authority of a pastor is not the same as that of a congregational meeting. The office does not exist merely for the sake of good order. It is a channel of apostolic authority. Ordination is not merely the transfer of the rights of the many to a single person. The office is not based on a human arrangement, not based on use humanum, but on divine institution, jus divinum. Ordination, therefore, has some kind of sacramental significance. Shudder to think of it. Melanchthon himself said it. These are his words. In the Apology, in the Lutheran confessional writings. If ordination is interpreted in relation to the ministry of the word, we have no objection to calling ordination a sacrament. If ordination is interpreted this way, as a ministry of the word, we shall not object either to calling the laying on of hands a sacrament. Well, if there's really no objection, I don't hear any objections. Let us call ordination a sacrament. For as Melanchthon continues, we know that God approves this ministry. It doesn't come from the will of the congregation. God approves this ministry, and God is present in it. It is good to extol the ministry of the word with every possible kind of praise in opposition To the fanatics who dream that the Holy Spirit does not come through the Word. That's Melanchthon. It has been salutary for Lutherans to feel the pressure of the Catholic partners in the ecumenical dialogues. The Catholic Lutheran Dialogue in the United States published its findings on the ministry in Eucharist and Ministry, a book, Eucharist and Ministry. Here we find the Lutheran participants in the vanguard of a healthy trend toward the recovery of a theology of a special ministry in the church. Their common statement defined the special ministry, I quote, as a specific order, function, or gift, charism, within and for the sake of Christ's church in its mission to the world, end of quote. They agreed that the office is not identical with nor derivable from the universal priesthood. The transference theory in this dialogue is rejected outright. God instituted the sacred ministry of teaching the gospel and administering the sacraments. This ministry has the task of proclaiming the gospel to the world and the upbuilding of the community. Through word and sacraments, the special ministry serves to unify and order the church for its mission to the world. The Catholic participants were pleased to hear their Lutheran partners stress Article 14 of the Augsburg Confession, which says, "We say that no one should be allowed to administer the word and the sacraments in the church unless that person is duly called." Duly called. The words for duly called are rite vocatus in Latin. And in this context, they mean purely and simply ordination. Ordination. These Lutherans agreed that ordination is no adiaphoron. It ultimately comes from Christ and confers a spiritual authority on the recipient in a once-for-all fashion. So close did these theologians come to a consensus that the Catholic theologians could make this statement, and I quote, "Now we see no persuasive reason to deny the possibility of the Roman Catholic Church recognizing the validity of the Lutheran ministry." Well, if that's the way Lutherans understand it, what stands between? Accordingly, it goes on, "we ask the authorities of the Roman Catholic Church whether the ecumenical urgency flowing from Christ's will for unity may not dictate that the Roman Catholic Church recognize now the validity of the Lutheran ministry, and correspondingly the presence of the body and blood of Christ in the Eucharistic celebrations of the Lutheran churches." That statement has never been said by any Catholic theologian since the schism of the 16th century. This dialogue left open the question then of how to order the special ministry. Catholics hold to the classical threefold order: deacon, priest, presbyter, priest or presbyter, and bishop. Lutherans have only one order of ordained ministers. How serious a defect is the lack of episcopal ordination and diaconal ordination on the part of Lutherans? That's a problem that they have posed for us. The ball is now in our court. Is presbyteral succession sufficient to secure continuity with the apostolic ministry? The original Lutherans had no intention of getting rid of the traditional episcopal order and discipline of the church. They were simply stuck with the undesirable fact that no bishop was willing to ordain pastors for evangelical congregations. In this dialogue, Lutherans admitted that now we are free to take steps to recover an episcopal structure and polity. I would like to refer you to the theology of Edmund Schlink. He was my professor at Heidelberg, an ecumenical-oriented Lutheran theologian, and a soundly confessional Lutheran theologian. Edmund Schlink has offered Lutherans a formulation that we should consider accepting that can prove helpful in dialogue with Anglicans or Episcopalians as well. That is succession through ordination by episcopal laying on of hands, he says, is not the sine qua non of the apostolic succession of church and ministry. That is to say, churches can live without it. Bishop Pike, the Anglican bishop, once said that, you know, well, we have the apostolic succession. Wouldn't it be nice if we Episcopalians also had some apostolic success? Schlink is saying that this episcopal succession is not the sine qua non. It does not produce an apostolic succession and authority, which are missing from the other types of ordination. Already during the Christological conflicts of the patristic church, it did not prove to be the unfailing remedy, securing the apostolicity of church and dogma, and this became clear as church history unfolded itself. On the other hand, we must see in the episcopal laying on of hands a signum, a sign for the apostolic succession of the ministries and the church. It is a sign. It is not the race. It is not the reality. It is a sign for the apostolic succession. It is a sign which is used to demonstrate that the church is Christ's church. Only when it is conscious of being founded on the apostles. The succession of episcopal laying on of hands is therefore a sign for the unity and Catholicity of the church. And he says, we Lutherans should therefore welcome the successive laying on of hands by bishops all through church history as a sign of apostolicity. And if it is absent, well, it is right for us to work for its introduction. That seems to me to be a theologically and practically sane view of the matter of episcopal ordination and succession. And progress is being made. But we shouldn't go along with it unless we become convinced that it lines up with the true doctrine of the church normed by the apostolic tradition. Much progress was made at Lima, Peru in 1982. Over 100 delegates there from many churches, including Roman Catholic representatives, unanimously adopted the statement entitled Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry. The history of this statement covered a 50-year process. It went through numerous stages of development. What is of momentous significance is its kairotic character. I know that many of you have read it and have already studied this document, and you have introduced it into your congregations. There are study booklets. I think the time is ripe for the churches to seize the moment of opportunity to capitalize on an ecumenical breakthrough that might serve as the next step toward the convocation of a universal council of churches at which the ministries of our divided churches might be mutually recognized. At the present time, churches are involved in preparing an official response to the Lima text. Churches are asked whether they can recognize in it the faith of the church through the ages. If Lutherans find it possible to participate positively in the ongoing process of reception, they will have moved a long way toward the resolution of the dilemma which they have inherited from the schism at the Reformation. No one is claiming that this document expresses a full consensus of the church, but it might be the next step, one next step that we can take, and that can lead to another step and another step. So I'm going to end right here because I see the time is running. But that is my final word. The recommendation that we take seriously the challenge that faces Lutherans today, not simply for the sake of recovering the episcopal ordination or something like that, but for the sake of the revitalization of the apostolic witness and mission in our churches today. It is for the sake of strengthening and deepening continuity. Many people are bemoaning the fact that we do not have any magisterial clarity in our pronouncements. Our bishops are not teachers of the church. This document is calling for a definition of the identity and meaning of the bishop's office, which is a far cry from what bishops are under the constitution of the ALC or the ALCA or the AELC. And so here we face a challenge. Whether we can go forward as a reforming movement within the church, never having had the intention to lose continuity with these offices. These offices are functioning sacramentally to give a sign, a witness to the presence of the apostolic voice of authority in our churches. Of course, in the history of the church, bishops have been heretics. Bishops have been schismatic, and so they're schismatics. And there is no guarantee, but we have here a sign of the intention of the church, even in very dark days, that the church lives and moves and has its being by continuing the voice of authority that stems from Christ and is mediated through his apostles and reaches us through now the succession of those who enter in to the ministry of the word. Well, I've enjoyed Holden Village very much, and I've enjoyed speaking with you, and I've enjoyed the other lecturers very much. It's been a retreat for myself and my wife. We're going back to Chicago, and we don't very often have this kind of a privilege to share with pastors, and certainly not at this pace and with such a rich program. So I want to thank you very much for inviting me here, Walt, and your committee, Light, and I thank you for your attention and for your hospitality here at Holden Village, Elmer Witt. I've heard so much about Holden Village. Now I'm going back to Chicago to start demythologizing it.